Okay, the Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development will come to order. Representative Moline, do you want to move the minutes?
So moved.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. First bill on the calendar is House File 698. It's called the Homeless Youth Act. Representative Halverson, it's her first committee meeting in this committee for presenting a bill, so she brought treats and she's going to make us healthy with oranges. The last committee I was in, it was a freshman who's a cop, and of course he brought donuts. but Representative Halverson used to work for a health company, so we get oranges. Representative Halverson, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing my bill today. I'm here to introduce the Homeless Youth Act, and this is a bill that basically modifies a law that was passed in 2007 that creates some minor changes within the law and then provides appropriation of $8 million. The appropriation has been part of the recommendation from a study that was part of the original legislation, and that recommendation was also made in 2007. This particular act has never actually received full funding. It's barely received partial funding, and we're here this year to request the full funding in order to kind of solidify the network that has been put in place since the Homeless Youth Act was passed. We have in Minnesota about 2,500 kids every night who sleep on the street or who don't have a stable or safe place to spend the night. One child in that situation is too many. The fact that we have 2,500 on a night when it's 3 degrees outside is horrifying. And the good news is we know the programs that work that can turn the tide for these kids. And it's not. And this appropriation actually will go to solving a problem. I think it's pretty exciting that we in the legislature have an opportunity to make an investment that actually solves a problem. And by investing in the nonprofit organizations who have helped create this public-private network for our youth and expand the safety net that exists, we are going to see great success in helping support youth. And I've got a number of folks from the organizations that are providing these services and who have built these network so that they can tell you a little bit more about the youth that they're serving and what this appropriation will go toward. And the first person that I would like to invite up here is Laura, and I just lost your last name. There you are. Laura Cadwell.
Thank you, Representative.
Just before you start, I have a question. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to figure out timings for the three bills. Is there anybody going to testify against this bill? Raise your hand if you are. Okay, thank you. Okay, so do you know how many witnesses you have?
There's five.
Five? Okay. Ms. Cadwell, welcome to the committee, and I'm never sure where, what department or issue I'm going to see you on, since I've known you about 30 years.
Well, Mr. Go. Chair, the good thing is I know where to find you.
Thank you.
Go
ahead.
Thank you for the welcome, and to you and to members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Laura Cadwell. I am the statewide director of Heading Home Minnesota, the Community Leaders Council, a public-private partnership of leaders from the philanthropic, business, faith, and government communities who are supporting the work to address homelessness in this state. In that capacity, I also chair the Metro Youth Systems Redesign Project, a collaborative of funders and providers of services to youth in the seven-county metro area. The project is maximizing the effectiveness of services to youth in the Twin Cities by working together developing common goals, outcomes, and approaches to youth homelessness, and speaking as a single voice on behalf of the vulnerable and often ignored population. I have one simple message this afternoon. It is that we can successfully challenge homelessness and its debilitating impact on individuals, families, and communities in Minnesota, not when we act as separate organizations, however strong and good our organizations may be, but when we draw together and align our efforts as a community. A decade ago, the state and many partners took on long-term homelessness and were successful in developing new approaches and bringing almost 4,000 individuals and families off the streets and into stable housing. Now today, you will hear from the leaders of three of the largest and most respected nonprofits in our community who are raising their collective voices to confront youth homelessness in our state. They will tell you how they have come together around a common approach to youth homelessness as they ask for your support for this work. We begin with Mai Kao Yang, President and CEO of the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation.
Thank you, Laura.
Ms. Yang, please just introduce yourself and
yes.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mike O'Hang, and I'm the President and CEO of the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation, a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to serving those in need, providing research and community building to address the low-income people in the greater St. Paul and East Metropolitan area. Wilder has been serving this community for over 100 years and is also a member of Homes for All, which is a statewide alliance seeking investment in proven programs to stabilize families, prevent homelessness, and create workforce housing. The Homeless Youth Act, which is what I'm going to be talking about today, is one part of our comprehensive agenda aligning so that we can find a place to call home for all Minnesotans. The problem of youth homelessness is one that can absolutely be solved. We should actually, if we look at our community, be pretty shocked at the tragedies that are playing out every night on the streets, not just here in St. Paul, our capital city, but in Minneapolis, in Albert Lea, Arden Hills, Woodbury, where I live, Zumbrota, and all over. Minnesota youth must fend for themselves like never before. Homeless youth make up the fastest growing population of Minnesotans experiencing homelessness. Over a recent three-year span, there was a 46% increase in youth homelessness, and this was even higher for 18 and 21-year-olds. The crisis is growing, but by taking action now, there is time for effective and affordable solutions. One of the greatest threats is that we accept homelessness as inevitable for these young people and for these children. We have better information now about how to fix this, and we can. We just have to make those decisions. So tonight, as with every night, there are 2,000 Minnesota kids who will have to find a place to hold their heads, put their heads down, and find a safe place in this cold to sleep. I'm going to share some statistics with you that I hope will help tell the story, and then I'm going to ask that some youth actually come up here and share their personal stories. But as I read the statistics for you, please imagine the faces of the teenagers in your lives. Each number I'm about to recite represents a child and his or her experience. So who are these young people? First, they live all over the state. 40% of these children actually live in greater Minnesota. They're being asked to instantaneously become fully self-sufficient adults the day they turn 18. 60% of these children have aged out of foster care or another social services setting. These are often young people who do not have a consistent or caring adult in their lives. Everybody think back to when you were 18. Most of us wouldn't have been prepared to go out into the world.
Yep. Representative Halverson, can you, we have to get to other bills eventually, and if she's talking about adding a bunch of testifiers and things, so I don't know, it's, maybe you can regulate time some on your testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will do
Thank
that.
You.
And perhaps we could, would it be possible to add just one youth testifier to the agenda?
Yes.
A couple of minutes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
These children aren't always welcome where they come from. More than half, 56%, were told to leave home or were locked out. Most of these children, 90%, are actually enrolled in school. they're choosing between a rock and a hard place. 30% had stayed in an abusive situation because they had no other housing options. These children are literally left out in the cold. In the Wilder survey done 1 October, one in every four reported sleeping outside in the past month. They're more vulnerable to sexual predators and other dangers in terms of living on the streets. Every night on the street puts them at increased risk of physical and sexual abuse, poor health, and suicide. Shelter beds are rare, and sometimes these children are placed in adult shelters, which is not appropriate or safe for them. Also, they're much more likely to have been victims of abuse. Nearly one in every two homeless youth has been physically and sexually assaulted, and 46% are struggling with mental health issues. In the best case scenario, some of these children are reunified with their families. Despite the difficult situations at home, many youth return to their families where they need supports from us to maintain their housing and care. The other thing I'd like to talk about is really that this is a very critical stage in a child's development. Along with the earliest years of life, these teenage years are the most critical periods in the development and transition to adulthood. It's when their identities form and their brains only mature around age 25. This means that some of the short-term choices that these youth make will result in long-term harmful consequences if they're not supported. It's important for us to think about this developmental stage and to disrupt the cycle of homelessness. We know that about a third of the homeless parents that are served were homeless as children, and about a third of the homeless youth were parents themselves. It's clear that many of these children have gone through a lot. But because we know what works, we can't sit on the sidelines any longer. So, in closing, we're not dealing with an insurmountable number of youth here. We know that these problems can be solved. Unaccompanied youth, Wilder's own experience with foster care schools and the mental health system and more, give us a holistic picture of the system. Tonight, over 2,000 children will need to figure out where to sleep. Homelessness is not inevitable, especially for young people. At the Wilder Foundation, we're committed to being a part of the solution along with community partners. And in closing, I'd like to actually have DeAndre come up and tell his story.
DeAndre, would you come up and just state your name and tell the story? Go ahead.
Oh, hi, my name is DeAndre. My name is DeAndre Dent, and I was born in Minneapolis, and I became homeless when I was 14 due to family problems. Me and my mom didn't see eye to eye on most things due to my own questionable decision making. I was kicked out, and that's when I was introduced to YouthLink and other homeless youth programs. Homeless youth programs in Minnesota are important because they get youth off the street. Youth that are homeless are more prone to criminal activity, and having agencies that specifically work with homeless youth help reduce crime by giving youth something to look forward to besides the streets. Instead of not progressing, these agencies help youth move forward. Agencies such as YouthLink and The Bridge help me. Today I'm proud to say that I am currently attending college. I have a great relationship with my family, and I have great rental history at the age of 20. Funding the Minnesota Youth Act will ensure that youth's needs are met and will be a huge investment to our state's future.
Thank you. Who is next? Is it Marnie Thomas?
Representatives, my name is Heather Hughesby. I'll speak. I'm executive director of YouthLink, and all I want to say is that when you met just now, DeAndre and Corey were here. These are just representatives of the homeless youth that we're seeing. We've had a 27% increase in the number of youth that are seeking services. We're using a model of collaboration with partners and connecting youth to those services. And that's what we're talking about in the Homeless Youth Act, is that we believe that we can solve this issue. We don't have to turn away tonight, as we're going to do in our facility. We'll turn away about 20 youth that are going to be home, no place to go. We've got 100 in the facility of just today. We encourage your support. We encourage you to get to know the DeAndres and the Corys of this world, because, like all of us, have young people, and it is hard to look at those young people and know there's still a light, and we can make a difference, and this investment would make a difference. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it Patrice, Representative
Chair,
Halverson?
I think that we would like to invite Tim Marks from Catholic Charities and Jody Harpstead from Lutheran Social Services.
Mr. Marks, would you go ahead?
All right. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Tim Marks, and I'm the CEO of Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis. And we serve 30 to 35,000 people in this region in various circumstances in need, from prenatal kids with their mothers, to children in crisis, to young adults, to adults and families in crisis, to older adults and immigrants and refugees. And the one cross-cutting issue that affects their ability to achieve their full potential is housing stability. And that is why housing stability and the Homes for All agenda, and particularly full funding for the Homeless Youth Act, is our highest priority that we present to you this session. Because we know that if somebody has a home, they're more likely to be a good student, a productive worker, and work to better the community and the other things with which they're involved. Conversely, if they do not have a stable home, they're more likely to be cycling in and out of public institutions, jail, detox, shelter, and that's tremendously costly for all of us, including the taxpayers, and puts a tremendous strain on the budget that you're trying to address this session. And that's particularly true for youth. As Michael Hang said, at the unaccompanied youth age, 16 to 21, that is an important time to intervene in somebody's life if they are getting off track. And we know that 90% of these young people who are homeless are in school, but only 50% or so actually attend class. We need them housed and in school. We know that if we can house a youth in that first year, they'll make about $14,000 in wages that will contribute to taxes and contribute to the betterment of their life. We know that if they graduate high school, they're going to make about $475,000 more in lifetime earnings, again, to allow them to be productive citizens. And if they don't, that will cost us all $750,000 during the course of their lives of lost tax revenue and increased public services. And so housing stability is not only a smart investment, it is also the right thing to do. And as we look forward to the Homeless Youth Act, one of the themes that we really support coming out of this budget and coming out of this legislature, let's not kick any more cans down the road. The Homeless Youth Act has been on the books since 2006. It has not been adequately funded, and we urge you to jumpstart it with adequate funding. And as you consider initiatives like Mini Minds and the school mental health, all of these things will support the development of our youth, will be sound investments for the future, and we urge your support, and we thank you for your work and leadership on this issue.
Thank you. Ms. Harpstead, I believe.
Thank you, Chairman Mullery, members of the committee. Lutherans and Catholics don't always agree on everything, but we do agree on this. I'm Jody Harpstead, CEO of Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota, serving neighbors in all 87 counties of our state and in our 148th year of service to the people of Minnesota. This year we came together in a design coalition with Catholic Charities, the Wilder Foundation, and the Metro Youth Services Redesign Council. We engaged the Public Strategies Group to work through a design process for youth services in Minnesota. We have a graphic of that design in a handout that you have in front of you. I'm talking about the page with this brave little orange person tossing out inner tubes to these kids coming down the stream. First, we see how life goes today for many of our young people in Minnesota. At the top left, you see the factors that cause young people to head downstream toward homelessness. A few troubled teenagers fit the stereotype of getting mad and running away from home. But most go home as soon as they see how life is on their own. Or if they come to us, we have a good conversation with them and send them home. The youth who are served by the youth services community in Minnesota have been abused and neglected by their parents and let down and let go by the foster care system. They need support while they finish growing up and getting a foothold in the adult community.
In the center is the youth provider community today, providing a safety net for youth and communities throughout the state with street outreach, shelter, family reunification, and transitional living. We're talking about John, who worked his way through our Renaissance Center in Duluth. He started a career in sales and is now effectively parenting his little boy, Jack. Youth like Tony and Sarah, who I met in Mankato this year, who received nothing from us but a drop-in center, counselors to talk to, and an occasional free pizza. Both of them are pulling down 4.0 grade point averages in college and on their way to productive adult lives. This network of providers gets results. All of the youth who've ever been served in our Renaissance Transitional Service in Duluth, for example, 90% remain stable in housing 4 years later. And while 2,500 homeless youth in Minnesota is 2,500 too many, we know there are tens of thousands of homeless kids in New York City and in Los Angeles. In Minnesota, we're close to being able to support every one of the youth in Minnesota who leave abusive and neglected homes. Of Lutheran Social Services, 23 different services throughout the state, youth services are some of the smallest investment, highest return that we have, and the least well supported by government. The youth provider network is underfunded compared to almost any other population in the state. We don't catch all of the youth who need us today. Some continue down this stream into sexual exploitation, crime, and adult homelessness. In 2006, when the Minnesota legislature passed the Homeless Youth Act, the youth community asked for $8 million in funding to make it work. It's time to make that strategic investment. On the flip side of your handout, you can see the world we imagine, where the safety net for youth, properly funded, begins earlier, even before youth become homeless, reaches more young people.
Ms. Harpstead, could you wind it up, because we're running into time and there's already some questions.
Thank you. Anyway, we stand a chance of actually solving this problem in Minnesota. Our coalition is asking that Minnesota finally put the $8 million into the Homeless Youth Act to fund our innovative ideas to get the 2,500 homeless youth in Minnesota off the street. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Harpstead, I think the last election proves that we Catholics don't always agree with each other. there's some questions. Representative Mara.
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, I was wondering if the Safe Harbor Homes, the program for victims of juvenile prostitution, will be eligible to share in these funds.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and members, those are two separate programs for the very reason that they're very different populations that we're attempting to serve in the state of Minnesota. And I would ask one of the experts from one of the social service agencies can explain why that difference is so stark.
If you look at your graphic here, the people that you're talking about in the Safe Harbors Act are in the category of the sexual exploitation on downstream. If we're unable to help youth when they first become homeless, many of them fall into that category later. That Safe Harbor Act is designed to fund helping girls escape from prostitution and get treatment to get themselves out of it and to overcome their post-traumatic stress. Very different kinds of services than the services we're talking about here.
Is that enough? Okay, thank you. Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Halverson, I'm giving you a chance to respond to a concern that might be raised that you didn't address, I don't think, in your opening remarks, but you are repealing the report element of the Homeless and Runaway Youth Act of the past, and I'm assuming, when I read the new language, that the grant process itself will build in elements of accountability, but that's my concern with the size of the funding change that is being requested here. What are the accountability pieces?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Reinert, that's an excellent question. I had the same question when I looked at the bill. And the repealer of the report is repealing the one-time report that was produced by DHS back in 2007. So, and that report was part of essentially the outcomes of that report is what helped direct us to the dollar amount that we were going to be needing. So it's not an ongoing report. I can ask our social service agencies to talk a little bit about how we report accountability.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Marks,
members,
quickly.
one of the things that we are working on between the Metro Youth Service Redesign, Catholic Charities, Wilder, LSS, is to make sure that we are redesigning the system that will achieve the accountability and the results, and anticipate that if you fully fund this, you will work with the Department of Human Services to make sure there are real results, real evaluation, and a good accountability so that you know that the dollars that you're appropriating are spent well.
Mr. Marks, don't you have some connection to working with MHFA, maybe, possibly?
Mr. Chair, members, I'd be happy to work with my former colleagues.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you might want to consider whether some element of accountability language is appropriate to the bill. You're telling me you will do this, but the bill doesn't say how you will do that. So I think it would be appropriate to address that explicitly, because as legislators, we're always asking, what are the outcomes of our investments? So,
good suggestion, Representative Briner. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see by some of the handout material that there's 40% of these homeless are in greater Minnesota. And yet, my concern is that we explicitly deleted out of the bill the piece that goes to providers in greater Minnesota. And so that's one area of interest that I'm concerned that we're going to neglect that 40% in greater Minnesota. And could you give us some examples of who's providing those services currently and the locations that they're at? And are they going to receive 40% of this funding?
Mr. Chair and Representative Howe, you bring up an excellent point. The distribution of homeless youth around the state is about the same as the distribution of youth around the state. It's not an urban problem. It's not a rural problem. It's all over the state. I'm a suburban member. This bill has bipartisan support from around the state. For that very reason that you bring up. And these services are being delivered around the state, and I can, these are statewide partners, and I think that Ms. Harpstead could address how youth are being served in greater Minnesota.
Ms. Harpstead, real quickly.
Well, I can sure tell you that over 75% of the work of Lutheran Social Services outside of the Twin Cities, and more than that percentage of our youth services are provided outside the Twin Cities. We've recently added services in Brainerd, Mankato, Wilmer, and Rochester. But I do want to check on the bill language.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Greater Minnesota.
You have to state your name.
My name is Kirsten Anderson. I'm with Lutheran Social Service in Minnesota. And this bill language has been a labor of love in partnership with providers across the state and here in the metro, as well as in great dialogue with professionals at the Department of Human Services. And the decision to do what Representative Halverson has done here is really to clean up the bill language so we're not tying the hands of the grant funders in the department, and they can distribute the funds as competitively or as determinative as far as the need goes. We at Lutheran Social Service provide services to young people in 6 communities in greater Minnesota, and certainly are very interested in making sure that those services are maintained and well-funded, and that additional services are provided to meet the needs of young people who we know have meritorious need. From a perspective of good governance, to make sure that the process is really seeking to meet the greatest needs, it was recommended that this language include the removal of a determination prior to the way in which the grants are actually competitively evaluated by removing that language.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just say that I believe that I'm concerned with the striking of that language, the greater Minnesota, because the greatest need is always in the behind, it's in the eye of the beholder. And without some direction on where those funds go, I'm afraid that greater Minnesota piece will be lost. So that's my concern.
Thank you. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to just say first is to thank you all for being here today and for Representative Halverson for bringing this piece of legislation before us, because we do know that the growing population of homelessness is among our youth, and that it's really, really important that we go upstream to prevent more of our young people from coming down the stream. And so I just want to do a quick shout out to the Wilder Foundation, who was in my district, for the work that they do in support of youth and the elder and the disabled, and just been a respective organization, not only in St. Paul, but I would say statewide, if not nationwide. So again, just thank you for the work you're doing here.
Thank you. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to echo the sentiments of Representative Breinert regarding, I think we do need some language. I think it's pretty important we need language regarding outcomes and then how we're going to measure that outcome. So with that as a basis, I'd just like to ask any of the testifiers a question. First of all, the work of nonprofits in this state is just tremendous. It's unheralded, and it happens without a lot of light shining on what they do or thank you. So thank you to every nonprofit who does the good work of the state. But my question is, how do we know, and it relates to outcomes and measurements, how do we know that the money being used won't fund existing programs as opposed to new things we want to do to make sure that we eradicate or reduce or eliminate homeless in our state? It's really a concern I have. How do we know that will happen? Well,
Representative Halverson, do you want to take that on?
I will start, and I will turn it over to my colleagues here. But first and foremost, your point about accountability is very well taken, and I think it piggybacks with what Representative Howe had to say as well about making sure that we are serving the entire state. And so this bill, we do put in the flexibility so that the state can fund the most effective programs and so that we can be guaranteed that our state dollars are going into programs that have proven effectiveness around the state. Additionally, I believe that making sure that, and I certainly am open to looking at additional language for accountability. I think that makes a ton of sense. And yes, and I'm going to let
The Wilder. Michael Hong, president of the Wilder Foundation. The Wilder Foundation has a very large applied social research arm. It's through the Wilder Research arm that we've partnered with nonprofits across the state every 3 years to actually count all the numbers of homeless people who are on the streets in shelter and transitional housing. The $8 million would not only be for services that are existing, but perhaps allow us to respond in areas where we know that we have a shortage of services. So there has to be some allowance for innovating, being creative, and actually becoming more effective. So as an example, in the East Metropolitan area where the Wilder Foundation is located in a primary service area, there are only 28 shelter beds for homeless youth in all of those counties. So on any given night, we are not probably reaching out and serving all of those children who are present there. We know, for example, that Ramsey County has a great number of children who live there. But, you know, I think that some of what we know through the counts that we do is what the characteristics of these populations look like, and also through partnership, figuring out across the state of Minnesota who's really there and who's not.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up as well? And I think that your point about old existing programs versus new programs, I don't think that it's a competition of one versus the other. I think what's been put into place since the Homeless Youth Act was first passed are some excellent programs, and we heard some examples of some of those today. We also heard that there are waiting lists of hundreds of children to utilize these services. And so the need is much greater than what these nonprofits are able to provide on their own. This will allow us as a state to invest in programs that have proven to be successful, that are responsible for success stories like we heard from Deshaun and from other kids as we've talked about this bill. And then it will also allow these nonprofits and the state to innovate based on what we've learned and based on needs. I think one great example is outreach. Homeless youth are hard to find, and these nonprofits have been involved in reaching out to kids and trying to determine where they are and how we can best get them into services, meeting them where they are, and we'll be able to increase those efforts along with additional beds and additional services, additional job training. So.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Representative Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Then that'll be the last question.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, I was wondering,
I would like to offer an oral amendment to your bill to repeal Section 3. And what that would do, it would reinstate the homeless and runaway youth report.
Would Representative Meyer, would you restate that again?
Mr. Chair, yes. I would like to offer an oral amendment to repeal Section 3. It's line 4.20 and 4.21. And the effect of that would be to reinstate the homeless and runaway youth report.
Representative Halverson, I assume you don't agree with that.
Mr. Chair, I think I agree with the spirit with which the oral amendment is offered. Representative Myra, however, because the report was a one-time report that was completed in 2007. Undoing the repealer won't actually change that particular law to create that accountability, but I would certainly, knowing that this won't be the last committee stop, would be willing to look at other language to amend this bill in the next committee, and would be happy to work with anybody on that who would like. And additionally, if members are interested, and Chair, I know that we're impeding on your time, but there is somebody here from the Department of Human Services who would be able to speak to some of the accountability.
Okay, I'll allow that for a couple minutes.
Mr. Chair, my name is Isaac Wingard from the Department of Human Services, and I just wanted to clarify the question that I'm responding to. There have been a number of things about accountability and the request for proposals process. I'm just asking to clarify the question.
Representative Meyer.
I can just speak to what we do with the funds. When we receive the funds of the Department of Human Services, we do put a competitive request for proposals out, along with other homeless funding. And that is a very competitive process. We get many times the amount of requests that we get that we actually have funds for. We do have a pretty extensive review process. We bring in experts from the field to review the kinds of outcomes that people are reporting, and also to review their programs. Additionally, once every 2 years we go out to do, at least once every 2 years, often once each year we do site visits at the program. So we have a fairly extensive process for ensuring that the highest quality programs are funded. We also look at the level of need in Greater Minnesota versus the metro area when we make awards. So that's all described in our request for proposals.
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, Representative Meyer. He had his mouth open, and I thought he was just spoken. Go ahead.
Mr. Burris has a possible wording for the oral amendment that meets the spirit of what I was trying to get at, and if he could share, that would be great.
Mr. Burris, do you want to?
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would read, if I'm understanding the intent for Representative Myra's oral amendment, would read page 2, line 21, after shall, insert annually by November 15th. Page 2, line 22, strike shall and insert must. Page 4, delete section 3.
Would you repeat that, Mr. Burr?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Page 2, line 21, after shall, insert annually, comma, by November 15th, comma. Page 2, line 22, strike shall and insert must. That one, by the way, is a technical change that I'm recommending. And then page 4, delete section 3.
Okay. Representative Halverson, my understanding is that you oppose this amendment?
Mr. Chair, again, I understand the spirit with which it is offered. My concerns are a couple things. Number one, I think we still have to repeal the request for the initial report, so we need to keep the repealer language in there. But additionally, I don't want to create duplicative efforts within our state agencies, which tend to cost more money. It is my understanding, and I can get some additional information, that these reports and audits are available already through DHS, I'm not sure that the additional language would get us better information.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. And yes, I think it's an awfully late amendment. I think it probably...
Mr. Chair, I can withdraw it.
Oh. Thank you. Okay. Then we really need to move this bill on so we can discuss the other two bills. So I'll renew my motion that House File 698 be passed and referred to Health Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Okay, we'll take up House File 358. Would you please be quiet as you leave the room? We are trying to conduct a hearing here. Do they have the prisoners? Loeffler, we can do Loeffler. What we're going to do is we're short the author right now. They're both voting in committee, but we're going to start on the Loeffler bill with the testimony. And who's moving it?
Mr. Chair, I would move the Loeffler bill, House File 358.
Thank you. Representative Moline moves House File 358. Where does it go? This is the one that goes to Health and Human Services Finance, which I assume you incorporate in your motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Regan, do you want to start with the testimony?
Certainly. Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Mary Regan. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, which is a statewide association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents. We want to thank Representative Loeffler for bringing this bill forward. I think as you heard in testimony several weeks ago when we did the big children's mental health overview, that there are lots of gaps in the system and some critical things that we simply don't fund that could make a big difference in the lives of children and families, and also in terms of efficiency and cost effectiveness in the system. And in this bill, there are a number of those provisions. Do you want me to walk through the bill, Mr. Chair, or?
I don't. Preferably not too long.
Okay. Some examples of the things that are in this bill that would make a huge difference for families and children are certified family peer specialists, and this would allow families to have support and engagement in order for them to understand what's going on with their children and understand the treatment options available. There's also school-based mental health services. You've heard quite a bit about that, and you will hear, all right, I'm going to skip that and go to service coordination. This is clinical care consultation that's between the professionals. We also have care coordination that is an essential service to make sure that the providers are all on the same page when they're working with children and families, and family psychoeducation services, really giving providers the opportunity to sit down with, welcome, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. Thank you for getting started.
To sit down with families and help them understand the diagnosis, the treatment plan, and the options. The only additional point, do you want me to continue? Or
sure, because I don't know what you covered, so go for it.
There is a pilot provider survey. This is a survey of providers of mental health services and children's pediatric services to start, to give the department feedback on the functioning of the managed care companies that oversee medical assistance. This is something the federal government does for Medicare. Minnesota doesn't do this, doesn't get input from providers, and providers have worked really hard to be efficient and effective in what they do, but there are some things that really we think we can help the system understand through a feedback loop that might make everything more cost-effective and efficient.
Representative Loeffler, did you have some additional things?
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and sorry, it's already that point in session where I had three committees, and we just voted on a very key bill. So I'm sorry I'm a little late. I just want to say that, you know, I think these kinds of pieces of legislation that we're bringing forward will create the net around kids with really serious challenges to identify them early and to make sure that we approach it with a comprehensive set of services that are reimbursable, because that's always the key to building those partnerships, particularly with our mental health providers who are, we have a workforce shortage, their time is very limited, so that they have an ability to really work effectively with each other and in a coordinated way. And I think that this bill, matched with some of the others on children's mental health, will help us create that comprehensive service that lets families and children and the services that serve that child, including their teachers, you know, be informed and effective and working as a team towards a good health outcome. And I think for our healthcare system, I think we've got a system of continuous improvement in a variety of different ways, and the provider survey just provides another set of inputs into that process. And with that, I would answer any questions. Did the Mr. Chair, did the A4 amendment, which is just the report due date, get moved? That would be appreciated. I think that was provided to the committee, but if not, we can add it in the finance division. Oh. It was just, we realized that we require a report back, and we did put a due date.
Representative Loeffler, we weren't given an A4 amendment.
Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I thought it had gone down.
Oh, okay. Not seeing any further questions, Representative Moline renews her motion to pass House File 358 and refer it to Health and Human Services Finance. Oh. Representative Howe, okay. It's technically too late. I'll let it go if you have a quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I didn't realize we were to the end of the testimony here already, but and I just want to clarify what I'm looking at here. We're establishing a whole new, creating family peer specialists, and we're going to certify those folks. Is that what I understand this to do?
Representative Loeffler?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and Representative Howe. This is a patterned after a successful project that's already implemented in Minnesota in terms of adult peer specialists. 15 states already are operating this for children. There's a national curriculum that's been developed and evaluated, and so it's a proven model. No parent is really prepared to deal with a child who suddenly exhibits severe mental health issues. They have a lot of questions about the system, how it works, what does this mean, and the support of other parents who've gone through that process can both make them feel less isolated and have a resource available to them, and it takes some of the pressure off the professionals in those lives too, just dealing with sort of the, you know, someone to share the stressors with and be supported in this journey.
Representative Myra.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I was wondering, on line 1.14 and 1.15, it says the new language is, third-party payer does not include a school district for costs for clinical mental health care. And I was wondering if that also covers charter schools, area learning centers, or other public school entities. Just was wondering if maybe at the next stop that could be clarified.
Representative Walker.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murray, I would be glad to check into that. My understanding is that they are all considered public schools, even though they're specialty type schools, and I think they would be covered, but I will make sure. The purpose of this is just to make sure they don't have ongoing obligations for doing a needed referral.
Okay. Representative Creech.
Thank you, Chair. Just very quickly, I noticed there's no fiscal note here. Is there any possibility of an unfunded mandate down the road or creating something that will need to be funded by the state? Is that foreseen at all? I realize this is federal dollars.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's the purpose of referring it to the Finance Committee so that it will get a fiscal note and we'll have an evaluation of that from the people from the state.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Nottenwolin again renews her motion to pass House File 358 and refer it to Health and Human Services Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you. Representative Fritz. Finance? Okay. Are you Representative Breinert?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that House File 220 is moved to pass and referred to Health and Human Service Finance.
Thank you. Representative Fritz, go ahead and present your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I served on early childhood, I think, the very first time you had. The committee was up and running, so I'm so glad that it is up and running again. It's very important. The bill that I have is House File 220, and I do have some amendments to the bill. Do you want to deal with those first, or how do you want
yes,
to proceed?
Yes, Representative Fritz, if you want to present the amendments, and which one do you want to take up first?
Or should I move my bill first? Did you move it? Thank you.
You can't move your bill. Representative Reiner okay. moved your bill.
Yeah, I thought if you don't mind, we could go to the amendments.
I'm told the A1 is the author's amendment,
yes.
Original. Okay. Everyone in favor of... passing A1 onto to get the bill in the shape it's that the author.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A1 okay. amendment.
Representative Moline moves the A1 amendment. I'm sorry, I thought Representative Breinert also moved that. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. I'll let you decide how you want to do it. Do you want to move all of them and then
I could
discuss them
the
all together, or do you want to do each amendment separate?
Should I give a brief explanation of the bill?
Representative Fritz, go
thank
ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For those of that haven't heard it before, what this bill does is tell the child provider in family daycare that the infant must be placed on its back while sleeping. An infant is any infant from like infant to age 12 or until the child, and I think there's an amendment here to deal with that, until that the infant is able to turn over on its own. So in the term infant then is from birth until age 1 or when that infant is able to turn on its own. In order to place the infant on any other position, its abdomen, its side, you would have to have a doctor's slip stating that to the provider, that the provider can only place the infant in another position other than its back if a doctor has prescribed that or brought a doctor's slip. The reason that I have this bill, again, and I did have it a number of years ago, is that just recently there's been a high mortality rate that has been discovered here in Minnesota of infants' deaths in some family provider homes. And this is a huge study that has been done, and there were like 32 or 34 recommendations that the health department came up with, and I would believe 12 to 15 of those were directly related to the position of the infant. So that is why I have put this bill back before you to give the provider some insurance, actually, and the parents that the infant will be placed on its back while in a sleeping position. That's essentially it. Very simple. And I do have Jerry Kerber here from the agency if there were any questions about the mortality study or any of those, the high incidence of death that has occurred recently in the state of Minnesota.
Are there any questions on Representative Kreese?
Thank you, Chair Mullery. Representative, how do you enforce this, and who's liable? I foresee a situation where, due to unforeseen situations, something bad happens, and suddenly somebody's going to ask who's liable, and I see a really potentially bad situation because of this.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative, well, the provider is always liable, and the provider carries liability insurance for that liability. Or is supposed to. Some don't. We found in some of these cases where the infant died and the parents then go with an attorney to sue, I suppose, in wrongful death, and then they find that the provider lapsed the insurance. But this is an additional tool for the provider in that they would have the note from the doctor saying that you can lay the infant on its side or abdomen because of perhaps a medical problem, and then that would also be a tool for the family, for the child provider. But they also should and would be necessary to have the insurance, and that would be enforced upon the death of an investigation of the a death of a child in an instance that process would take place. And I could invite, I'll ask Ms. Dolesland if she wanted to comment further.
Ms. Dolesland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dolesland, and I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association. We represent the licensed child care centers around Minnesota. And I do have Michelle Wilson here who will give some more details, but I just wanted to make this clear. This requirement is a condition of having a license as a child care provider, whether you're a center or a family child care. And if the Department of Division of Licensing finds that you are not meeting that requirement, it will impact your ability to hold a license to provide child care services. I'm going to let Michelle talk a little bit more because she works in a center and has a little better understanding than I do.
Would you state your name?
Yep, my name is Michelle Wilson, and I'm the Director of Especially for Children and here today representing MCCR and the Minnesota Child Care Association. And I'm the Director of a Licensed Center, and as it stands right now, we are allowed to sleep children on their belly with a note from the parent. The only change that this would make is that we'd still be able to allow children to sleep in an alternative sleep position. We would just be required to have a note from a physician. So if our licensor were to come for a site visit or unexpected visit and see an infant sleeping on their belly, if we didn't have documentation that baby could roll over on their own, we would have to have documentation on site saying that the physician had given us permission to sleep that child on their belly, or we would have a violation on our license and it would impede our ability to continue serving.
Thank you. Representative Risha, follow up.
Thank you, Chair Miller. Just to follow up, I apologize, but we do realize that out of the blue, a baby can start to roll over.
Yep.
That amendment addresses that.
Okay.
Representative Risha, you have to talk to your fellow members there. Representative Powell.
So, thank you, Chair. Okay. I guess I got a question as far as why isn't the parent note good enough on that? I mean, to go to a, isn't that the parent's right to decide which way the child gets a chance to sleep and how they prefer to sleep? As a parent of raising four kids, I mean, I think as a parent, most parents understand the risk and what's involved in that, and if they give that, and as a child care center, if you have that note from the parent, I would believe that that would be an enforceable document in court to protect you from a libel suit.
Ms. Wilson?
May I go ahead? I totally agree. Parents should be allowed to have a say in their child's care plan. Parents are the child's first caregiver, and they know their child best of all. And this would not take away the parent's ability to make that decision. It would just make one more step in the process and give parents one more opportunity to be educated on the risks of sleeping their baby on their belly. There's the risks that surround this are something that's fairly, you know, that with the Back to Sleep campaign, a lot of this information and these statistics have risen to the surface, and all of this knowledge is out there. Parents don't necessarily always have access to that information or access to that educational piece. And so when a parent comes to me and says, I would really like my baby to sleep on their belly, they sleep better this way. Right now, my enforceable legislation states that they have to sign a note, and I kind of walk them through kind of the risks of this and the possibility and how much it raises their possibility of SIDS or sudden infant death syndrome. And now they can just sign a note and then we flip baby over on their belly. This wouldn't stop that from happening. This would just create one more conversation with their physician, where their physician would then have the opportunity to educate them on, if this is really what you want to do, then we'll go forward. But one more opportunity for them to hear the risks.
And Representative Fritz.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could, I would like the testifier to give her testimony from beginning to end, and she'll cover all of those, and then I think we could go to questions, if there are any questions after she does. So could you please go again?
Sure. Ms. Wilson.
Sounds good. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Wilson. I'm the Director of Especially for Children Child Development Center in Eagan. And I'm here today representing the Minnesota Child Care Association. I want to thank you so much for allowing me to come today and testify in support of this legislation to require a physician's signature in order to allow child care providers to sleep an infant in any position other than on his or her back. The recent Back to Sleep campaign has offered an enormous amount of education around the risks of stomach sleeping and the benefits of back sleeping. But child care providers throughout the state are still allowed to place infants to sleep on their stomachs with a note from the parent granting permission. Although many providers have created policies preventing this, the difficulty still arises when a parent adamantly requests an alternative sleep position. This creates a struggle between the parent and the provider. Passing this bill will not eliminate every struggle over sleep position, but it will create another line of defense for providers and another opportunity to expose parents to the education regarding the real life and death implications of stomach sleeping. We do realize that there may be some opposition to this law, such as you stated, parents should be allowed to have a say in their child's care plan. Parents are a child's first caregiver, and they know what's best for their child, and sleep is so important. With all that said, requiring a physician's signature would still give the parents a say in this decision, allowing them to seek out another resource in support of their desire to sleep their child in an alternative sleep position, such as on his or her tummy. Requiring a physician's signature would allow one more opportunity for the parent to be educated against the risks of stomach sleeping. And discussing sleep position with a physician could also bring to light other medical conditions, such as reflux, that may be impeding a child's sleep. And will also address issues such as co-sleeping and placing items within the crib, all of these which increase the risks of sudden infant death during sleep. Education during prenatal care and during early visits with the child's provider can give parents the information necessary to discuss sleep patterns and options with their physicians at their well baby checkups, thus allowing parents to obtain a physician's signature if desired without having to add another visit. The goal being that parents would receive further education on the benefits of placing their infant on his or her back and the dangers of stomach sleeping, and ultimately resulting in a parent deciding to sleep their child on his or her back rather than in his or her stomach. The American Academy of Pediatrics has stated, with the implementation of the Back to Sleep campaign, sudden infant death syndrome has dropped by almost 50% in the United States. Although sudden infant death syndrome rates are declining, it's still the leading cause of mortality for children younger than a year. This accounts for 56 deaths per 100,000 live births, which is weird statistics. But what that averages out to is 2,500 deaths per year, or 7 babies dying per day. 1 in 5 SIDS deaths, or sudden infant deaths, occur while the infant's being cared for by somebody other than their parent. By passing this proposed legislation, we're not taking away the parents' rights or underestimating parents' knowledge of their children. What we are creating is another step in the process, in hopes that parents will have the opportunity to be educated on the benefits of sleeping their child on their back. The rates of infant sleeping deaths are falling, and it's our goal as educators to continue that trend and to educate the parents in the process. If this legislation can educate just one parent and save just one child's life, it will be worth the effort. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lane, you had a question.
Because of some other work I've done here, I have a connection with some medical examiners, and one of them contacted me to say that if she could be here, she would be here to testify for this bill. So instead, I had her send a letter, and I've had that distributed. But basically, we've seen far too many infant deaths in which unsafe sleep environment has caused or contributed to the death of the child. New parents are regularly counseled by their health care providers on how to ensure that their newborns are sleeping safely. Ensuring that this is also the case in daycare is very important, a key step. And then this, I found this statement profound. As medical examiners, we find preventable infant deaths among the most tragic and distressing of any deaths we investigate. And they would be called in for any such case. So they are front line saying stop. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fritz. Will doctors actually be willing to sign a note and take on that liability?
Representative Fritz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Meyer, I would hope so. They take an oath to do that. That's their job. And this is upholding the law that they would be, you know, if there was a reason, they would have the law behind them. And they would be, I don't think a doctor would be against if there was some real reason to do that. It's between the doctor and the patient, of course, and I think the doctor may 9 times out of 10 educate the parent as to the back sleeping and why it's important, but if there was a real physical reason, he would be doing his best, I suppose, to do his duty.
I'm going to go to Representative Franzen because I think you have 2 amendments. Is that correct?
Do you want me to talk about the amendments now?
I'd like to get the amendments handled within the, so we don't run over.
All right. Thanks, Mr. Chair. First, to Representative Fritz, I absolutely love your A1 amendments, so thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And then I would like to move, we'll move first, the A2 amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What we'll do on this one, since it's not an author's amendment, we'll, you've moved it, so we'll discuss it and ask the author, first of all, to do you approve of this amendment?
It's a good amendment. I do approve of it.
So right. The author approves it. Do you want to state, like, in 2 sentences?
This just just clarifies there's some confusion about what it means to have a tightly on the mattress. This just kind of clarifies things a little bit.
Okay, thank you. All in favor of all in favor of Representative Franzen's A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. That's now on. Representative Franzen.
All right.
You want to move again?
Yes, I'd like to move the A3 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Franzen moves the A3 amendment, and Representative Fritz, do you have an opinion on it?
It's approve the amendment.
Okay.
Sentence. clarifies. There's licensors out there that don't know if it 12 months, 30 days, 31 days. This says a year. End of discussion.
Okay. All in favor of Representative Franzen's A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. All 3 amendments now are on the file.
And
Representative Franzen, you have an excellent testifier there because she's from God's country, North Minneapolis. So
yes,
we have to make sure that she gets on. Go ahead.
Hello again.
Ms. Blake.
Hello.
Hi.
My name is Marlena Blake, and I'm a child care provider in North Minneapolis. And I've been doing child care for over 10 years. And I am in agreement for a physician to sign off that an infant can sleep in alternative position, because it's very, very important to really have that conversation with lots of parents, especially newer, young parents that are using the child care and often frown when someone says, when I would say, oh, you cannot, we cannot lay the baby on his back. I mean, on his stomach, he has to sleep on his back. And they're like, oh, well, this is how I do it all the time. And, you know, the baby sleeps just fine. So I think it should not be just up to us as providers. It should be for everyone who is involved in the care and the well-being of the child, so that we can address that early, especially with doctors. And parents do believe and listen to the doctors more than they probably want to listen to us. So I think it's a really important piece of conversation and information that would help the parent and also help to protect the provider as well as the child. And so I'm in agreement with that. And if you have any other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Howe, did you have a question?
Yes, it's basically a follow-up where I was going before. So thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is there any documentation that parents that have signed the alternative sleep position form and have read the Minnesota Sudden Death Center's information in relationship that have gone through the current process? Do we have numbers and data that of the infants that have died in relationship to that have signed the form and have read that information?
Representative Fred.
I'm going to ask Mr. Kerber then to address that question.
Mr. Kerber. Go ahead.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, excuse me, from the Department of Human Services. And to your question, one of the things we did when the Child Mortality Review Panel report came out, we went around the state and met with provider groups. We met with one group in Rochester, one in St. Cloud, and one in Minneapolis, or in St. Paul. And we heard a lot of stories about child care. One of the things we did here in Rochester was a very compelling story about a woman doing family child care who wasn't at the meeting, but several times she was brought up as being fairly traumatized by the fact that an infant had died in her home. And in that instance, what was remarkable about that was it was one of those cases where she had not wanted to let this infant sleep on his stomach, but she did because the parents signed the notice. And so she complied with the parents' wishes, and the infant died. I don't have numbers for how many of those there were, but I know there have been a couple in the 83 deaths that have occurred over the last 10 years. The parent consent notion went into effect in 2007, and since that time there have been a few deaths where the parents had consented to the sleep position.
Representative
Powell. And thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any documentation that said that they actually, you know, because I think we call it SIDS because we don't really know what happens. So if is there any documentation that those in that 4 or 5 year time period here, mm-hmm. 6 year time period that we know exactly what the cause of that was, or is it if it was SIDS? You know, I guess that's my concern is we're going down a road and changing something that possibly really is okay and isn't really going to have make an effect.
Well,
Mr. Kerber,
what we know is, you know, SIDS is a medical diagnosis after death that sort of has ruled out other causes of death, and I think we've heard testimony that it's not always a real consistent determination of that diagnosis. But some of the numbers that we do know, in those 83 deaths that have occurred over the last 10 years, 65 of them, or 75%, were associated with an unsafe sleep arrangement. And so in 75% of those 83 infant deaths, the child was in an unsafe arrangement. Sometimes it was a child on his stomach. Sometimes there were other things in the crib. How many of those were actually diagnosed ultimately as SIDS? I don't know that information. There were a lot of them where an infant's face was buried in a mattress, or there was a pillow in the crib, or there was a blanket that smothered the infant, or in some cases an infant choked to death on a strap in a car seat. So they weren't. They certainly weren't all SIDS deaths. And the focus here is not, I think, not necessarily to absolutely prevent SIDS, but it's to decrease the likelihood of it occurring, because we know that this is a risk reduction measure.
Representative Howell, I'll give you one more follow-up. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Others staff too.
I guess my concern is I'd be really interested in those from 2007 till now, when this got enacted, to see what effect this has had, and if we're going down a road that we've made substantial success in already. That's
thank you.
Mr. Chair, I could add one number to
Mr.
that.
Ferver?
In those in the 5 years before the 2007 change, there were 26 deaths in family child care. And in the 5 years after the change, there were 51. So the number of deaths more than doubled after the change that allowed parental consent. So I'm not saying that that's causal, but I'm saying that there was a pretty dramatic increase in the rate of deaths in family child care after the 2007 legislative change.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr.
Last
Chair.
Question.
Well, and it's kind of more of a statement, not really a question. Of course, we could talk about SIDS all the time. But first, if the public is watching and they think that this has turned into demonizing child care providers, this isn't it at all. And I share Representative Howe's concern too about taking that parental responsibility, but also being on the other side of being a child care, I can understand the liability. I couldn't imagine if this had happened on my watch. Mm-hmm. Because the provider always is assumed guilty first. When something like this happens, and then they have to prove that they are innocent. And so that is just, nobody wants to deal with that. But also with SIDS, not only with the stomach sleeping, more education to the parents need to be done about smoking, drinking, drug use during pregnancy, poor prenatal care, prematurity, low birth weights, mothers being younger than 20, tobacco smoke exposure following birth, and overheating from excessive sleepwear and bedding, along with the stomach sleeping. So it's not just stomach sleeping. There's a lot of things, too, that need to be taken into account. What is actually happening outside of the home of the child care facility?
Okay, thank you. Representative Reinert renews her motion to pass as amended. Mm-hmm. House File 220 and referred to Health and Human Services Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned.
Thank you, members.